Welcome to Board Gamers Anonymous, the podcast about board gamers and the insane fun we have at the table together. This is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And this is episode 374, the new Gateway Games, children's games? We'd like to thank all of our Patreon backers for help bringing us a brand new episode. Well, welcome back, everybody. We missed you. We were, mysteriously gone for a week. I mean, we were with you in spirit, but we were gone for a week. But we're back in person.
We are. We are back and healthy, and everything's fine. Nothing's wrong. So those who those of you who reached out and were like, hey, what's going on? You all right? Where's my content? We're fine, guys. Everything's going good. The world being what it is, things happen. Health issues pop up. People get sick. And then you just got to take the time. But everything's good now. We're happy. We're back to the board games, doing what matters most. Sharing with you what games we want to buy and played and you should buy or not buy and definitely not pay shipping on.
Yeah, I think in this day and age, anytime there's a small glitch, it's almost like, yeah, the end of the world, right? It's going to be the end of the world. It's totally the end of the world. But we are still here with you, thankfully, and so glad that you joined us here this week at the table. So we get to talk about the most fun that anyone could have with cardboard on a table. I guess on the, other than a pizza, right? Because you get a pizza in a cardboard box. Mm. That is a lot of fun. Yeah.
True.
That's a hard
pizza
one.
Pizza is a board game. Yeah. Pizza's pretty good.
Know. Pizza is good. But board game is crunchier? Yes. Board game is crunchier, right?
Mm, good call. Good call.
See, there you go. There you go. Yeah, I pulled it out, man. But yeah. So speaking of cardboard, as we do each and every week, Anthony, I don't know about you, but you know, it does feel like the end of the world apocalypse coming and, you know, might as well play a board game that's related to that. And, you know, in a world where the only thing that we have to look forward to is Marvel movies, I don't know, maybe somebody out there backed Marvel Zombies from CMON. And
no,
no, not even a little bit.
No, no, not. And I'm really glad I didn't. I know where you're going with this, and I'm really glad I didn't.
All right. Well, I mean, considering that everything is bad, everything is wrong, everything's upside down. What could go wrong, Anthony? with a $9 million.
Right. Yeah, no, it's okay. So this was a Kickstarter. I don't remember when, not too long ago. I think in the fall, and it went great. You know, they made all the monies in the world. I think, yeah, $9 million plus some stuff after the fact. You had, I don't know, 12, 13 boxes of stuff, get a giant Galactus. I was very tempted several times to go in on this because I do like the new Zombicide format, like Zombicide 2.0. The rules are, they're sleek, they're streamlined. It's fun. There's a lot of stuff in here, but I didn't go in on it because trying to save money and just not knowing I'm not going to play this anytime soon. And then fast forward 5 months, 4 months, whatever it might be. And, you know, the pledge managers are up. They're asking people to pay their shipping, get this ready to go in the next year or so. And hey, guess what? Shipping is obscene. So the original estimates were like $100. For shipping, $50 to $100. And then when they finally came in April, it was like $155 for the single wave shipping. And if you wanted two wave shipping, which got you that, like the base stuff early and the rest of it later, you were talking about $200+, right? And that's domestic. That's here in the US where CMON is located, where they're shipping from. If you're overseas, oh boy, good luck with that. So it's, you know, people are upset. Understandably, because you're paying hundreds of dollars extra. Somebody posted on Board Game Geek, I saw this earlier today, it was a $300 difference if you chose to get Galactus versus if you didn't, right? So the cost of shipping for Galactus alone is more than double the cost of Galactus, or no, is almost half the cost of Galactus by itself. So you're paying all this extra money. Anyways, the point is, a lot of people are paying this anyways, of course, because they all in on the game. It was already hundreds of dollars. Why not pay the extra couple hundred? But man, you know, that's so much money. And people who just backed like the base thing with all the Kickstarter bonus stuff, paying like 100, 150, and all of a sudden it's double that with the shipping. So much. So crazy. And it's, I don't know. We could blame CMON for poor communication for sure. It's not their fault that the pipelines, the shipping pipelines are completely messed up. But it's a mess. It's a mess. I don't know what we do about this as a hobby where the things that we loved cost hundreds of dollars to move from one place to another, because it's going to price it out for a lot of us.
Yeah, I think this is an issue that we've seen for a lot of our friends in, like, I don't know, the Pacific Islanders especially, right? You know, a lot of the countries in South Asia, they always get creamed for this. I remember way back in the day, like, you used to see Kickstarters and it would be like price, ship, ship, ship. And then sometimes it'd be like, here's New Zealand and here's Australia. And then like, you know, and then the shipping was double or triple the prices in some cases. And you really felt terrible for that, because it's got to be hard enough to get, you know, substantial games down there to begin with. And then the prices are just so exorbitant, you know. And I guess the real issue here, as you said, Anthony, there's just things that are outside everyone's control, and no one's necessarily like hardcore to blame, I guess. But also at the same time, there's been a lot of bad communication and terrible rhetoric and just, you know, and I'm not, you know, it's one of those situations where we're all on the same team. We want to support the designers. We want to support the publishers. We want to make sure that they have what they need. I mean, there's no bigger fan of board gaming than all of the people who pay all the money for these board games. We're not just the general public. You know, it's something specific. It's something that we're purchasing, and we're purchasing it for a reason. And now the shipping's at a point, and it's been at a point for quite some time now. In fact, this is just the newest iteration of, like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
So it's already slowed down, if not stopped, a lot of my Kickstarter purchasing. And that's kind of a shame. You know, and I want to throw one last thing in here about that too, because I was using Kickstarter way back in the day when Kickstarter, or the idea of Kickstarter, was like you were supporting a project that could not be produced otherwise. So you were investing money in a project that was taking 1, 2, or more years. So there was a partnership because you were making an investment. And that's still kind of true. So if CMON or other companies are asking for that amount of money in shipping, or charging like crazy rates for their games, I don't know if I feel comfortable with handing over money to a company for it to sit for like 2 years, where I could purchase something now, or I could make, you know, a couple of pennies in interest, but at least it's in my pocket. Instead of like, here's $400 that I will not see, you know, come back around to me for 2, 3 years from now. That just seems wrong. And I think that's something that's often missed out on, is that Kickstarter is not just some online store. It's an investment in a product in order for it to be produced.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. Yeah. And like a lot of these companies treat it as that. They treat it as like a pre-order system. But yeah, then you get, like, I'm looking at my own list and I'm, you know, one example is Queen Games, right? And I know they've had a lot of trouble with their own pipeline, but yeah, I had backed upgrades for Shogun, and I backed the first run of Stefan Feld stuff. And both of those now are like 14 months and 11 months overdue. And I don't know when they're going to ship. And that's, I understand why it's happening. This stuff happens all the time, but that's a company that theoretically has the budget to print things, right? They don't necessarily. And if they don't, that's problematic, because they've been around for a while and they do have a business and a model and employees and budget. It's not like, you know, an Isaac Childress in his basement building out Gloomhaven for the first time and being like, I need money to publish this. It's, hey, we've got a new game. We just don't want to take on the financial risk. And that's, you know, obviously that's what CMON does. It's what a lot of these big companies do. And I don't necessarily have a problem with it, but when we're looking at hundreds of dollars in shipping, or multi-month or year delays, or just crazy, ridiculous, obscene prices with all these add-ons you don't really need, it just, I don't know, the system starts to feel a little broken, you know, and it's frustrating.
It's the investment model to it that bothers me, because again, once upon a time, there was a scenario where you, as somebody who was back in a campaign, got to make substantial, I wouldn't say feedback necessarily, but you got to say things content creators and publishers listened to you. And then there was this round table of communications on about the product, because it was something you developed together. And I think what you said, you know, Gloomhaven is the perfect example of that. Here is the single creator publisher who needed the support and the financial investment so that he could produce a game. But Queen Games is not that company. And Feld's games have been out in different iterations for quite some time. There's no reason those games should take that long to print. And regardless of the shipping, there's other ways to go around it. So, yeah, it's really hard. It really is. I mean, I feel bad about it. I mean, there's nothing good about this. There's nothing to feel good about. It's just games are taking longer to produce. They're taking longer to ship, and they're more expensive. In around every part of it is more expensive to produce. And we live in a day and age of 3D printers. So I don't understand. They have to find a different model. They have to find a different way to produce in the countries in which they're going to ship. They're going to have to do it, because at some point it's just going to burst, and that's it. I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I would be perfectly happy with MSRP being 40% higher if it didn't mean $100 shipping charges. Right.
Yeah.
But I don't know where it ends up. And, you know, we don't know all the details of why these things happen necessarily, but at a certain point, it's not even like we're mad at the company, you guys are terrible. It's more of just like, we just need to come up with a better solution. And so if whoever's working on that, get working, figure it out. Because I don't know, I'm not a logistics guy.
Well, like I said, any publishers out there, content creators or designers out there who are mad at people for being mad at the prices are missing the point.
Right.
We are legitimately the people that want you to succeed, want you to be multimillionaires, right? There's no one who's a gamer who doesn't go, you know, like, is not the biggest fan of their board game designers or their small companies that are publishing those games. We want you all to make all the monies. We just want you to take some time to find ways that it doesn't cost us all the monies. We want you to make maximum profit from it. We do. There's nobody who ever, you know, opens a board game and just like, that was a great game, but if only the publisher or designer could make less money off of it. We never do that. It's just, it's hindering the industry. It's hindering gameplay. And I think we'll talk about today, Anthony, in our feature review, how board gaming for us, for everyone who's listening out there, seems to be the thing that's easy to pick up, easy to get to the table, and easy to play. I know there's some sarcasm in there, but, you know, somewhat, right? You could get those games to the table. With the costs and the delays for these games, the general public doesn't have that knowledge of experience in gaming that maybe they once did. So everything becomes a lot more difficult. So for today's feature review, we'll be talking about the new gateway games and why, in fact, they actually might be children's games. I think we're going to blow you away in a little bit. But Anthony, before we get into our feature review and everything that's happening with us, let's talk about what's going on with BGA and our listeners out there. We have a little bit of an Instagram giveaway, I hear.
We do. Yeah. So we get a lot of things that come in. We get a lot of resources. We have a lot of games. And so we have built up kind of a log of relatively recently released games that we want to give away to the listeners, to the followers, to the readers. And we're going to be doing that on Instagram. So if you do not follow us on Instagram now, please do. We're Instagram.com/BoardGamersAnonymous. You can follow us there. We post gameplay photos. We post our questions of the week, all that good stuff. And right now there is a post pinned at the top that says real big giveaway time. And all you have to do to enter that giveaway is share the post, like the post, comment on the post, right? So if you are following us and you do any of those things, you'll be entered for a chance to win one of 5 games that we're giving away in May. These are, again, great games, relatively recent ones. We have a copy of Smartphone Inc. We have Tavanusi, Origins, First Builders, a couple other games in there as well. So hop in there. You'll have a chance to win one. The winners will be announced on May 30th. So right at the end of the month. And so you have plenty of time. You got 2 more weeks to get in there and get a chance to win one of those.
All right. So that's what's going on with us. Again, we want to hear from you, connect with us, and we're going to drop some pretty major cardboard on your table with or without a pizza. We haven't decided yet. You'll see. You'll see what comes in the mail. All right, Anthony. So let's talk about the games that we want to get to the table. Let's talk about our acquisition disorders.
All righty. So for me this week, the game I wanted to talk about is Terracotta Army. This is a new one just recently announced by Board and Dice. It's designed by, I'm going to mess up this name so bad. Preslimslaw Fornal, worked on Blossoms and Kwiatki. And then Adam Kwipinski, I know how to say his name, who we all know from Nemesis and Lords of Hellas and Frostpunk and lots of other good stuff. So they've developed Terracotta Army for Board and Dice. And they just recently announced this game. It's going to be releasing later this year. And if you're not familiar with the Terracotta Army, it is the emperor in China. And I don't remember exactly when, but they passed away. And to protect him in the afterlife, a massive army of statues of different warriors were developed and guard the tomb, right? These were found and still intact and or like this great archaeological find, right? So in the game, you are the craftsmen and the artists building the statues, and so you have to collect resources, as one does, upgrade your workers, as one does, and seek favor with the advisors to the emperor who are overseeing this giant project. And so you basically have to be the best builder of terracotta warriors, and those things are going to go into the mausoleum. So you're going to have little miniatures, warrior miniatures that go into the mausoleum themselves, forming different groups. And these are going to be based on different types of players that go in there. And you're also going to be gathering different resources to be able to do that. It looks really interesting. It's a different kind of theme, and it draws on something culturally without necessarily stereotyping or misrepresenting that culture or adjusting the history of it necessarily. It's looking at a specific element of a historical find, and you're building towards that, which I think is a cool idea. So it looks cool. It's an interesting way to put miniatures into a board game. It makes sense. Like, a lot of times you see miniatures in Euro games, you're like, that doesn't need to be there, that could be a meeple. In this case, you're like, nah, you should have miniatures for the Terracotta Warriors. That makes sense. So, I'm looking forward to seeing how this one turns out, to getting a chance to play it. I think they said it's coming out towards the latter half of the year. It's one of their fall releases. So we'll keep an eye on it. And hopefully when it hits shelves, tables, etc., we have a chance to get it out and give it a play and let you know what we think. But for now, I'm keeping my eye out for Terracotta Army.
Nice. Yeah, I did see this too. It looks great. And like you said, it makes sense to actually for once have all that plastic,
right,
you know, on the board, because, you know, it's truly representative and thematic for the game. Yeah, excited. I'm going to throw us back to something a little bit old that we had talked about before. We had reviewed it. It recently was up on GameFound and it backed. So you have an opportunity now to do a late pledge if you're interested. This is the Palaces of Carrara. This is the second edition from Game Brewer. This is from Michael Kiesling and Wolfgang Kramer. And this is a game that I've talked about quite some time ago, at least the original one, the Palaces of Carrara, where this was a game that I didn't think it was going to see a USA release because it was in Europe and it was pretty much locked down. And I think I got a German edition at some point. I still have it. It doesn't have any English direction in it. A friend of mine had picked it up years ago and was able to get like the little, you know, little text, you know, you can kind of slip into his sleeve so you could figure out how to play the game. And it was a game that was a lot of fun. It was all about purchasing marble in different regions in Italy and building up all of the different buildings. So this is a game you can also find currently on Board Game Arena. It's an older game, but it's a lot of fun. And it really, it implements one of these kind of really interesting mechanics where you put out the marble and the marble's all different colors and the wheel will move throughout the game. You'll be able to, you know, move it. And as the wheel moves, the marble becomes cheaper and cheaper. So it's one of those things, almost like a press your luck situation where how low do you let something go before you pick it up? But initially, and again, based upon what kind of buildings you're making and what kind of regions you're building, and there is some marble that's more expensive than others. So there's a press your luck element, and then there's a race element. And in those different regions, you could either score money, which will allow you to buy more marble, or score victory points. And you're trying to get there before anyone else does, because once you're able to build the building, you lock down that city. And there's also a lot of, set collection in the game. But it's a very fun, dynamic game that, just did not get the love, at least initially, when it first came out. And then recently, when I found out that it was coming out of second edition, I was really excited about it. It was one of those games where I did like it enough that I would almost consider purchasing it a second time. And Game Brewer brought it out. And again, it was on a Kickstarter game found kind of situation. And again, it was a very expensive version of it. Now, Game Brewer, and I've talked about Game Brewer a lot, I really like the games that they choose to produce. But I really hate the prices that they decide to, put out for their games. Like, famously, like Gugan came out, and I was like, this seems nice. It seems like a lighter game. Way too expensive. Ooh, Paris. I like Paris. I'm definitely going to do... Nope. Way too expensive. And this is another game where it's not a super rich Euro, but it is a good Euro. It is a classic good Euro that you do get to pick the pieces from that wheel. You do get to, press your luck, and you do get to race to build those different buildings in those different areas. And it's a solid game. You can pick up a late pledge currently on GameFound for about $78. Even with the updated components here, it is still honestly a little too expensive for me. I already own the original version. This obviously has better pieces to it, but there's nothing dramatically different. If you could buy if you could find the other version of this or the earlier version of it, it's probably just as good to pick up, but it's been out of print for so long. So I just want to bring to your attentions the Palaces of Carrera. It's a classic Euro game that, since it did not get a US release, did not get the attention, did not get an English release even. So check it out. It's on GameFound. If you can manage the price, if you can manage the shipping, or you can manage it once it actually gets to retail, which I probably would recommend, definitely check it out and pick it up. That's the Palaces of Carrera.
Yeah, this game is on my list. Like, I've been meaning to play this forever. Like, I got to get you to pull out your German copy so we can get it played. Like, I didn't back this because I'd never played it, and it was crazy expensive. But
yeah,
I do want to play it. I've heard a lot of good things.
Yeah, it has a little mini expansion with it that makes the game much more rich, right? It just adds an extra level to the game. Otherwise, it's a good classic Euro. But yeah, you definitely want to play with the expansion. Never play without the expansion. All right. So let's talk about the games that actually hit the table this week. Anthony, I did the thing that I did not want to do, the thing that I was talking about earlier, which is I spent all the monies on a game and all the monies on a game that I knew going into the game was certainly on the lighter side of gaming. And in fact, it was a game kind of that I already owned. That game is Marvel United X-Men Edition. I backed Marvel United when it first came out. The miniatures seemed great. They were chibi based, which is not a, it's not a bad thing. It's just a different thing. And the miniatures, of course, since they were coming from CMON, were so good. I was like, yeah, I'll back that. And I backed it, and it's still somewhere collecting dust. When the X-Men came out, I was like, who in their right mind would actually back this? You already have Marvel United, which has like a ton of stuff. Like again, it comes with so much stuff in the base box that it could be a lifestyle game. You could certainly pick out either of these Kickstarters and play it the rest of your life, right? This could be your game. You could be known for this game. Your family could play this game. There's so many characters, so many combinations. It's a co-op game. Sure, this could be a thing. Here's the thing, and I've talked about this before. You all try to talk me out of it, and you didn't do a good job because I did back it. I'm a huge X-Men fan, like way back in the day, X-Men fan, before they became huge, before even the cartoon back in the 90s came out. And I was collecting X-Men comics way back when. And again, I'm not the first person to do this. X-Men been big, I guess, since the 60s. So when this campaign came out, what was really interesting about it was it did make upgrades and changes to Marvel United. You got additional cards to play. You got additional modes to play. So not only was it just not just co-op, but you could actually, again, based on this massive Kickstarter, there were versions of the expansion boxes that would actually allow you to play as teams against each other cooperatively to try and get the best score. Or you could play one versus all. You could actually play as the enemy versus the other players, which is amazing. And they also have options in the game where thematically some of the villains in the game who, again, if you know the movies or you know the comics or anything else, sometimes they're good guys for some reasons. So you can actually play with them as hero characters in the game, which is also awesome because that's thematically true to the universe. And especially for the Marvel universe, you get a lot of that. Now you're seeing a lot of that in the movies, but the X-Men were really, I feel, and again, I'm not a comic historian, but again, hundreds of comics, X-Men were very much about this kind of uneasy challenge / truce where all the mutants were seen as different. And again, without going into all the political ideology and all the changes throughout time, was this idea of feeling different in the world and some people taking different measures in order to be accepted or be secure. So you always had this conflict between the different mutants, some doing just straight up super evil stuff, some doing kind of evil, some doing so-so, and then like the hero characters. So there was some crossover back and forth. So I did like the idea that there was multiple ways to play this game that were very thematically true to the X-Men, you know, series as a whole. So if you back the original, you know, Marvel United, you got all the Marvel characters, which is wonderful. And I did back and I got all that kind of stuff. And mostly because I feel like the Marvel universe is something you can trade on right now. Like if you brought this to the table, probably for the first time, people will be like, oh, I understand who, you know, Star-Lord is, right? Whereas, you know, before those movies came out, no one knew who a Star-Lord was. I did, but that's just me. Now with the X-Men, obviously, eventually they'll get their own movies and they'll kind of come into like the public sphere more than they already have with their own movies. But for me personally, this was one of those things where I've always loved these characters. I wanted to have, and I had, you know, growing up here and there, some toys versions of this. This gave me all of the characters. I mean, practically not all of the characters because goodness knows comics. This gave me all the characters, gave me a lot of different ways to play it, gave me a lot of different scenarios to play it. I could go on for hours about these different scenarios, but these different scenarios relate to the comics. So when you look at the boxes and you're like, huh, what's this about? Turns out there was a whole comic arc related to that. There's also Deadpool in there where most people know. There's X-Force in here. There's the Fantastic Four for some reason were in this collection, which is great for me because, yeah, I backed it. So there was a lot of different ways to play the game, a lot of fun, a lot of upgrades. I backed it. I got it. I'm still waiting on the playmat, which is delayed again because shipping and stuff. Now, the actual game itself, if you have not played even Marvel United or the X-Men version of it, is rather simple. Basically, you're going to choose between 2 to 4 heroes. And again, you can play this solo. So you could play the characters because, again, the base set of the game is actually a co-op game. There is a solo version of this game. It's the Professor X version where you could play solo. But it's a co-op game, so you could play solo anytime you want. But it's nice to have that solo game in there. When you play the game, you'll pick up three characters. The base set comes with your traditional X-Men characters that we all know and love, like Cyclops and Storm and Beast and Wolverine. Choose three characters, choose two characters, four characters, whatever works for you. I find three characters works best because when you play the game as a co-op, basically what's going to happen is the villain plays their, you know, attack card that's going to do something that's going to interact with the game and characters, usually causing damage to your hero characters, or again, based on the scenario and play. So I don't know if you're an X-Men fan, but the first movie had Senator Kelly in it, who was against mutants, and Mystique is trying to, you know, end his life because she's trying to protect mutants, but she's a bad, it's a whole story. That scenario is actually in this game. So again, awesome, fun, thematic, love it. But also, it adds different gameplay elements. So you actually have an escort mission in this game. But the reason why you play that is because the villain plays one card. This is the game plays the same every time. Villain plays one card. Then your heroes play their card. So if you now at the start of the game, you get to play three hero cards. Again, there's so much to this game. I don't want to go into any kind of detail. We've already talked about that. There's basically attack. There's movement. There's, you know, special hero effects where you could save bystanders or attack the environment, which is usually very bad. Or there's this general kind of like wild token. There's also, and this is what I really like with this game, more, even more so than Marvel United, is they spent a little more effort putting in special cards into this game that are really thematically true. So Wolverine heals, and again, there's an endless number of variations and stories I could tell you with this. I'll save it for a Patreon episode. But for now, know that in like a deck of 12 cards, you're going to get, again, between 3 to 10 cards that are going to be very thematic to that particular hero in the game. And as you play a card, you'll also be able to benefit from the card that was previously placed. So you get to do a lot of things in the game. It's not a hard game. You're basically playing cards. The cards are also your health. You're trying to achieve whatever particular scenario in the game needs to be achieved. Typically, it's trying to save enough bystanders, trying to knock out enough thugs, or try to stop enough threat in order so you could take out the villain in that scenario. That's pretty much typically, again, the other boxes add a lot of different variations and goals and outcomes. But you're trying to do that before the villain runs out of cards because that will mark the game. There's a couple of ways the game comes to an end. That is also one of the ways that the game comes to the end. So you are racing the clock throughout the game. You move around through different locations using your chibi miniatures. The miniatures are really high quality. The detail is pretty impressive. Now, again, it depends on the character. Some characters, you could see they spent like a crazy amount of love and care. Gwenpool, I don't know if you know Gwenpool, there's a long story with that. She has amazing detail, whereas some of the other characters, not as much. But I've seen pictures of these, people have painted them, they look amazing. I have not played all the different modes here yet, but I played absolutely everything in the box, in the main box that most people will pick up. I played all the villains, I played all the heroes, I picked in other heroes to bring in from like the other boxes. They all play slightly different, and I feel like they play just barely enough to kind of substantiate if you do love this universe of characters to pick up the stuff, because each of the hero characters and villains do something different. So Juggernaut, for example, is one of the villain characters. His main thing is he'll run around all the different locations and just not stop, and he'll do damage to everybody. That's basically what Juggernaut does, right? Not super complicated. The card quality here is not the best. It's below average. The chit quality, all these little different tokens that you get in the game are above average quality. I didn't pick up the plastic tokens, which now I kind of wonder, but in fact, the tokens are very good quality. The boards themselves are a little thin and flimsy. I did pick up the mat, still waiting for it to come, hopefully to better protect things. You can sleeve the cards. The boxes are individuals. They kind of work to hold everything in. The actual plastic insert that holds the heroes and villains are marked, so you know exactly where everything goes back. But there's such a thin plastic that one of my boxes, when I opened it, they just, some of the spots already cracked. So some of you out there don't care. We'll kind of like put everything in bags or just throw all the figures in. They're high quality. They're not going to break or chip or anything like that. But nonetheless, it's a nice set. It's a nice game. I like the fact that you can play this co-op. It's easy, but it adds enough variety for the heroes and the villains that with just a few minutes of reading through the rules, you get a sense of what comes into play. I haven't played the team variant yet. I look forward to that. I'm really looking forward to the one versus many. That looks excellent. And in fact, when you play some of those variants, there are actually additional hero and villain cards that come into your hand that allow you to do special comic book related tricks and attacks and different special abilities. Again, haven't played that version yet. I think that version will be even better when you're actually playing against other characters that are controlled by players and not just a typical co-op game. So again, a lot to love in this game. Again, has so much of the characters that really fit. For example, Storm, who has her 90s version Mohawk. She didn't have her, you know, lightning powers and her weather control, so she punched a lot. So the actual character here has punching. That's basically what they do. Old Man Logan, if you watched Logan, the movie out there, was retired, did not want to be involved. And if you read the comics, you get more of why that was a thing. So when he comes out, he built up a lot of attack, a lot of rage, but he does not do anything until he gives up, you know, being retired and comes back into play. And then he could hit like crazy. So again, thematic, plays good throughout. The huge collection is huge. I don't recommend it to anyone who's not an X-Men fan, because you can play this game and not know anything about X-Men and make sense of how the cards play and what they do. You don't need any prior knowledge to this, but I feel like the miniatures are only something an X-Men fan is going to love, because they're almost every character is here. And the cards themselves are related thematically to the characters. So for me, this gets a play. I'd like to see the other different gameplay elements to move it up to a buy and feel like I could sleep at night. But right now, it gets a solid play. If you are interested, definitely check out the base box. I don't think you need everything here. The different modes are only available, again, with some of the other expansion boxes. So pick and choose. But this is also backwards compatible to Marvel United, so you get to use all the different characters in different ways. If you're a Marvel fan, you're probably going to back this. If you're an X-Men fan, you're definitely going to back it. It's a play for, I would say, everybody, and a buy for those kind of hardcore X-Men fans.
Ah, yes. So glad I didn't back it, because I'm not a hardcore X-Men fan, and I can play your copy at some point and be like, cool.
It does have Sentinels in it, which are like, they're not Galactus size, but they're big. So
that's cool. Yeah. I mean, the only thing I wanted out of this was the Fantastic Four and the Sentinels. So it wasn't worth paying whatever $200 and something for.
I know.
They look cool.
They do. So yeah, I'll be checking out the other modules over the next coming weeks and months and years, I'm sure. So I'll, you know, jump back in and let everyone know how those things are going. All right. So that's everything that's hitting our table. Let's get on to our feature review. So our feature review this week is the new Gateway Games. And turns out, I know this is shocking to a lot of us out there, they're probably children's games. So,
what?
Anthony, my friend, we've talked about this. And before we get canceled, let's just finish the episode and see if we can kind of let people know why that is a thing. Now, you have, I guess, the most direct experience of this recently. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, I should preface this, too, so it doesn't come off the wrong way. I've mentioned this a couple times. I'm teaching a class, a college-level class about board games, specifically a composition and rhetoric class in which I use board games as the text that students are evaluating. So instead of reading books or watching movies, they're playing games and then writing about them. It's very cool. It's a lot of fun. And students are having a blast. I'm having a blast. But the thing that I found is not that students are struggling necessarily to wrap their heads around the games. That's not surprising because board games can be complicated. It's that I have underestimated how much scaffolding and how much preparation and like building we need to do to make it accessible to everyone, right? So if I put a game that we might normally consider gateway, like Dominion, in front of 22 students, maybe 15 of them are like, cool, I got it. But then seven, it's a little much, right? There's a lot going on there. And if I go up much above that, looking at games like Wingspan, which we talked about a couple weeks ago with the famous Mandy Patinkin video, brains will explode. Like, it's too much. And it's not that the game is too complicated. It's that it's throwing too many things that are unfamiliar and new at the same time, right? There's no reference points. There's no like framework to build on there. And so the cognitive load is so high that people just shut down, which is not what we want. We want to introduce games to as many people as possible and for them to have fun. And in my case, for them to be able to write about them. But if it's like, here's 11 new things you have to learn all in one game, it's just too much stuff, right? And so it turns out that one of the best ways to deal with that is to go to the games that don't just boil it down to a single mechanic, which is what gateway games typically do, but boil it down to like a single type of action, which is what children's games do, right? They try to make it as accessible to as broad a range of people as possible, while also having to be fun for the parents who play the games with the children, right? That's a huge thing because you can't just pick a game that's like, oh, this is simple, so people who have trouble engaging with the game, they can play it too. It needs to be people who have trouble engaging with the new types of rules, but also everybody else who maybe is okay with the more complex rules, and everybody can have fun together. That's a tough spectrum to find. It turns out children's games developers have been doing this for decades, and there are a bunch of games that already do it, many of which are already on my shelves because I have children. So that's what we wanted to talk about, is these games that do a really good job of being accessible to a broad range of ages, boiling it down to one or two very simple mechanics, making it accessible, not dumbing it down to the point of being insulting, but still giving enough for people to latch onto and learn about games and get into the hobby. So hence, new gateway games, right?
Exactly. And again, I think that's also part of what we've seen with the prices and with Kickstarter, is that more and more these days, even though the industry is growing, it seems like it's harder to get those challenging games out to the public so that they can encounter them in a meaningful way, but also have enough people playing them that there is real experience and real teachers out there. Because I think generally what we see happening out there is like the, you mentioned the Mandy Patinkin video, where looks at it, tries it, gets so frustrated and just is done with it. Mm-hmm. And when the prices are high for games, they don't get to the table or general table. Like, you're dropping $60, $70 on a game, you want to believe that you can actually play that. But, you know, it's there's a barrier of entry for things as well. But you, as you mentioned, Anthony, the scaffolding is key. So oftentimes, and maybe you could talk a little more about this, Anthony, like just the term gateway games. We've used that a lot. We've had several episodes. I can't remember how many episodes we actually had about gateway games and what that means for our industry and how often we promote gateway games as what the general public would find accessible.
Right. And I think that's the key, right? We say gateway because we're inside of that gate and we're thinking like, we want more people to come in here. This is a great, big, amazing theme park that we're in of board games. We want more people to come in. Here's the gateway through which non-gamers can join us. So these are the games that are not too complicated, don't take too long, and most importantly, don't introduce too many new ideas, right? Like at a base level, we have to assume most people have not played anything more complicated than Monopoly. Many of them have, but we can't assume they have, right? Some people haven't played a board game in 20 or 30 years. They just haven't. Yeah. So they're coming in and you basically have to assume no knowledge. You know, they understand dice and cards and that's about it. So if you throw two different mechanics at them at once, it's too much. And so a gateway game is supposed to be designed to be like, here's one mechanic and we're going to, you know, delve into it as deeply as we can. And that's it. And that's all the game is. Like, you do one thing. But some of the gateway games don't just do the one thing, right? Ticket to Ride is one of the most famous gateway games. You're building up a hand of cards based on what you pull up, and then you're placing trains down. And so everybody can understand that basic idea, right? Nobody that I've shown this game to, none of my students either for that matter, have had trouble understanding the basic idea of get cards, spend cards, build trains. But where they sometimes get stuck is the different routes, right? Like, oh, I can't go there because someone else has already gone there. And I'm like, oh, there's no way to get to that location now. Or, oh, that's cut off. Or, oh, how do I draw more tickets, right? How do I get more points, right? There is a little bit of scaling in that game from just basic mechanics into doing well that people can get hung up on. Dominion is very similar. Like, yes, you play all your cards, you buy new cards, they get more powerful. You play all your cards, you buy new cards. But building an engine with those cards to actually effectively convert all that additional resources that you built up into buying victory points, that's a gap that some people struggle to cross if they've never played a card game and they've never even heard of deck building. And so those are things that, not just with non-gamers, but just people coming to game night for the first time, families, you know, friends, family members, especially like at holidays, often this comes up of, this is a little too much. There's a lot going on here. You know, anytime a game takes more than 5 minutes to teach, people might just look at you like, this is a lot. I don't know. And those are the games we consider to be gateway games, right? Your Splendors and your Ticket to Rides and your Dominions. People still find those to be too complex. And, you know, we can roll our eyes at that, but then the people still aren't playing the games. They're not coming through our gateway. So we got to find other games to show them how fun it is. And once you give a baseline, you can then add all those extra bits, right? Like, okay, you understand the core idea of building out these cards and doing things with them. Okay, now let's layer in the idea of victory points and building a deck, right, in Dominion. But you have to have the basic layer first, which I think is what we're sometimes missing. And then we're just like, okay, well, you're just not a gamer. You don't want to play these. That's fine. Moving on. But maybe they are. Maybe they would have fun. We just threw too much of them at once.
Yeah, in a way, in a strange way, those gateway games that are supposed to be welcoming become gatekeeper games that keep people out. Yeah. Right? So sit at a table and now try to mentally juggle three different mechanics in your head at the same time. And they're just like, but wait a minute. Like, nope, you got to juggle three, not just one. You got to juggle three. So if you can't do it, you can't be with the cool kids at the table, just saying. So there is, as you said, Anthony, there's something very wise about what they're doing with children's games. And as far as the scaffolding is concerned and introducing mechanics and outcomes, and again, a lot of things that we take for granted are complicated and unknown. I think we've talked about this many years and we talked about it on the podcast. When you play a Euro game, for example, and it's your turn, or let's say it's a worker placement game more specifically, there's always that spot on the board where you could take victory points. And especially early in the game, the person who takes that spot, either there's nowhere else to go, and that's kind of like a consolation prize, or if they take that early in the turn order, you're like, oh no, that person's going to get creamed. They haven't played games before. But it would make perfect sense that if victory points is the thing that wins the game, you would take the spot that would be giving you victory points. So it's more of a complicated thought-inducing process than I think all of us probably really considered. And I think that, again, some of the games you put together here, Anthony, do a great job of introducing those different mechanics in a way that it may seem like children's games, but really what it is an opportunity to learn some complicated mechanics that open them up to brand new worlds.
Yeah, so like I've chosen a few games specifically for the fact that they are not, they don't feel strictly like children's games, right? You might hear some of these and be like, I play these games. I'm like, great. That's what they're for. They're supposed to be as accessible as possible. These are all games I've played with my kids and I also have fun with. And I think that's the most important part, because you can't just throw a Haba game in front of somebody and be like, here's a basic mechanic, figure it out. Now let's do something harder. That's insulting, but also not fun, right? Because you're doing something that's designed for a 4-year-old or a 6-year-old or whatever it might be. These are games that are designed to be as accessible as possible for ages as young as 5, 6, 7 years old, but also speak more broadly to people outside of that age range. So yeah, let's dive into these. First on the list, and this is the one I've had among the best luck with, both with students and my children and at conventions, just across the board. And I don't know that it's necessarily marketed as a children's game, but it's certainly in that weight range, is Hey, That's My Fish. And so this very, like, at the beginning of the game, you put all your penguins out, and on your turn, you just move it and you pick up the fish where you were standing. And that's it, right? The emergence in the gameplay here comes once you've played it once or twice, and you start seeing how you can cut people off and block them out and cause them to float out to sea, right? And take larger chunks of the ice flow. That's not necessary to understand the game, but it builds naturally through the gameplay. And I think that's super important in games like this, is the actions you take should be very, very simple, but something should come from them beyond just the immediate thing that you gain, right? And Hey, That's My Fish, you move, you get a tile with some points on it, but you also get to impact the overall game board. And that's when people are like, oh, okay, I could see what happens here. I could see how I can mess with people or how I'm being messed with. And that clicks almost immediately for anybody. Like, whether they're angry or happy about it, it clicks right away. That's why it's such a good game for that. Next up on the list, we have a couple of cooperative games. And so there's a lot of co-op games people label as gateway games, Pandemic and Forbidden Island kind of foremost among those. But in my experience, those games still have a lot going on, right? And they are designed for you to lose. They're both designed for you to lose like 75% of the time, which makes it less accessible. People don't like to lose over and over again, right? And you can remind them like, oh, you're supposed to lose, but it doesn't mean it's fun to lose. Zombie Teens Evolution, I think Evolution, is a cooperative game. And it's actually, like, I think rated number one on Board Game Geek for children's games. But it's also a legacy style game. And that's interesting because it doesn't really break anything, but it does add new mechanics as you play. It does add other things. But the most important thing is it gives you challenges to work towards that unlock stickers, that unlock things in the game. Because the basic mechanics of the game are very simple. It's just to keep the zombies away and then gather up the stuff you need and escape, right? It's not hard to do that, unless the game, you know, bends the wrong way. But if you have a specific challenge and something to work towards, it scaffolds in new ideas, it scaffolds up and gets more complex as you want it to, and you can attempt to do more difficult things. The very basic version of the game takes 10, 15 minutes, and you're probably going to win. That's great. It's a great way to introduce cooperative play, also to introduce like new mechanics coming into the game. Ghost Fight and Treasure Hunters is another one. It's in a little more traditional style co-op game, where you run into a building and you're trying to find these different treasures, but then ghosts are popping up. And if too many ghosts pop up in an area, they become haunted and they grow into these giant red ghosts. It's very similar to Pandemic, but it simplifies it with just a single deck of cards. You don't have to have any cards yourself to spend. You're just moving your character based on a die roll. And the game doesn't beat you as often, right? It's fairly accessible in that way. Now, the game also comes with ways to make it harder, and there's an expansion that then makes it even harder. So you can scale it up from the very basic level of difficulty, where you might lose 20% of the time, up to adding the cellar, which makes it so you lose like 60% of the time if you want that harder challenge. So then again, you're layering in difficulty up and up and up. These games are ones that I'd recommend playing for people who've never played a co-op game, never played anything similar to that, and are skeptical of it, before you jump to like a Pandemic or Forbidden Island, where you have all this extra stuff going on, but also you're gonna lose a lot. And people just getting used to that idea of co-ops not necessarily being easy or winnable. You're gonna lose. The next three here are kind of staples of children's games. We have dexterity games in general, and there's a lot of them. There's a lot of really good dexterity games. And honestly, any of the dexterity games that are for adults would also be fine for this, because they don't tend to add too many rules. You're flicking, you know, pitch car, you're flicking around a track, flick them up. You're just flicking bullets at different characters. Junk art, you're stacking stuff on top of them, each other. But these ones kind of boil it down even more, make it more accessible. Rhino Hero, you're folding cards and stacking them. We've all done that. Everybody's done that. Very, very simple, but it's also very fun because you're trying to see how high you can get. Ice Cool, you're taking these little Weeble Wobble penguins and flicking them around inside of a frozen high school. And you get Ice Cool too. You put them together, you get a giant school, and you flick them all over the place. At a very base level, you're just trying to like complete the circuit. But if you want to make it more complex, you can try trick shots. There's all sorts of cool stuff you can do with those little penguins. Animal Upon Animal is one of the all-time classic dexterity games. I know a lot of people who don't even consider this a children's game. It is marketed as one. It's from Haba. But you're stacking little animal-shaped meeples on top of each other to see how high they can get. That's it. That's all you're doing. But it has its own challenge. There's other ways to make it more complicated. It adds different layers to it. So these are all great ways to introduce how mechanics can kind of interplay with like physical interaction with the game components. Dexterity games, right? You're just physically doing a thing, but then you're gamifying that physical thing. Most people are familiar with Jenga. You add in something a little more complex and it becomes more engaging. Labyrinth is another really interesting game. There's a lot of versions of Labyrinth. You can get the classic version. This is from Ravensburger, a classic version with the little wizards. You can get Harry Potter Labyrinth. You can get all these different types of labyrinth based on different themes, whatever it might be. But the basic idea is you're taking a tile and shoving it into a giant labyrinth. It changes the layout of the labyrinth. And then people have to, you're trying to reach different items based on the cards you have and then get back to your starting point. There's a bit of a memory component. There's some spatial components in terms of like being able to figure out how the tile that you place will affect the overall maze that you're moving through. There's a race component. You're trying to do all these things before your opponent. But at the end of the day, the mechanic is take a tile, place a tile, move your guy. That is it. Right. So anybody can do that. And then all the other stuff that comes from that builds off of that action, which I've found is A, you can teach it to a child in 30 seconds, which is great. All you need, which means you can teach it to anybody in 30 seconds. But also, it can get kind of complicated, right? You're trying to look at like 3, 4, 5 layers deep, and it scales in difficulty, right? If everybody playing it's an adult, you're all going to be thinking at these more complex levels of how to move through the maze, and it gets more complicated. And some of your moves can be made to block other people instead of just trying to help yourself. Also, something that doesn't always become apparent in other types of games. Another category of games I wanted to mention is the My First series. It's not one single company, but there's a lot of these that have come out over the years. So there's My First Carcassonne, My First Stone Age, My First Castle Panic. Ticket to Ride has First Journey for the US and Europe. Some of these are out of print now. So I think Stone Age in particular has been out of print for a little while. But if you have any of these, if you find any of these, they effectively take gateway games and strip out even more of the rules and make them even more accessible, you know, for children for sure. But also if you're just dealing with a large group of non-gamers who don't want to be overwhelmed and would like to be taught a game in 5 minutes, this is a really good way to do that. You're taking out layers of things that might otherwise be a barrier to entry. Karuba is another great game. And the reason I put in Karuba specifically, A, it's from Haba, so it is definitely marketed as kind of a family, kids' weight game. But B, it's effectively a roll and write. Right? You have one person flips a tile, everybody else takes the same tile, you all place the same tile. Right? So roll and writes are like this, flip and writes are like this. Karuba is the same, but it's very tactile. You're not drawing on anything. There are tiles for every action you take. You're building a map in front of you, and you're moving a person through that map. Roll and Write's I feel are also equally accessible, but they're not quite as, a lot of people have a very similar reaction to you, Chris, of being like, I want to play a game. I don't want to write on a piece of paper. I want to play a game. Karuba is a game. You're playing the game. And it's very, very simple because you don't even really have to choose anything. You're just, someone's going to tell you what tile you're going to place. You take that tile, you place it somewhere on the map. That's it. That's all you're doing. And you're just trying to do it the most efficient way possible. So it definitely scales accordingly. And the last one here from like the children's pile I wanted to mention was Rory's Story Cubes, which is not a game at all, really. It's more of an activity, but it is one of the most engaging activities that I've had success with, of people of all ages, my kids, friends, family, students, whatever. People love these things. And you can gamify it if you want, like further than it already is. But really, you're taking these cubes, you're rolling them, and based on what pops up, you are developing some kind of story. And there are like different types of rules that come in the box that you can kind of work with. But effectively, it's a handful of dice with different pictures on them. And it allows you to, you can use it to feed into role-playing games. You can use it to build out like a group storytelling exercise. You can use it to like do like an apples to apples style thing where different people come up with different types of stories and you choose which one you like best. It's a lot of different ways to do it. But at the end of the day, you're rolling dice and discussing what's on those dice. People dig that. It's fun. It's also really, 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 really simple. So there's no rules. Let's roll the dice and do whatever we want with them. So those are a bunch of good kids games, right? I have a little list here I put together of like adult entry level games that do resonate well with children that I've had luck with that kind of, I would almost consider them children's games, because they are so simple. Patchwork is brilliant. The more I've played this and the more people I've played it with, the more brilliant I find it. It is very, very simple and everybody gets it. You know, don't even worry about teaching people rules about like the little patch, the extra patches or like income and stuff. Just worry about when they get there. Like you move the pawn, you take a thing, you pay for it, you put it on your quilt. Done. Right. It's one mechanic. And then there's a couple little rules that go after that. Ticket to Ride New York and London. These don't fall into my first category, but they are like boiled down versions of the larger Ticket to Ride formula. Much smaller maps, much quicker game. You can play it in like 15, 20 minutes, which is great. It's been really, really great with kids, but also just anybody. It's a good, quick filler version of Ticket to Ride. Abstract games in general, but specifically ones that look good and are appealing to children. Santorini is a blast because you can remove those cards and just play the basic game, or you can add the cards in, which is like a fun little extra layer of complexity. Splendor. We mentioned Splendor before. This is a great gateway game, and it is fairly straightforward to teach people, especially because it starts to play itself towards the middle half of the game. So very accessible for just about anybody to kind of get their hands on. Other games kind of similar to Splendor, you have games like Century or Her Majesty's Service. These games also do interesting similar things where you're just playing cards and they kind of build off of each other. Potion Explosion is, if you remove kind of the extra elements of scoring from this game and just focus on take the marbles and place them to complete your potions and get the most potions in whatever amount of time you're set for the game. I feel like there's family rules in one of the expansions that does this, but my family, the way we've always played it is whoever gets to, once somebody gets to 5 potions or whatever the combination of potions, I can't remember the exact number we used, the game is over, we count up our points. Kids loved it. It was fine. We didn't really worry about the extra abilities. We didn't worry about the bonuses or any of that stuff. Just taking those marbles out of the dispenser. They love that. It's so easy, but they love it. And then King Domino, because it doesn't get any simpler than King Domino. This is, you know, I would put this up there in terms of like gateway games as one of the better ones, just that is all purpose, all family. Now, this is from Blue Orange, which means it is more family oriented. Your decision tree is very small. You only ever have 4 options if you're going first. And if you're not going first, you often only have 1 or 2 options. And you're going to take that and you're going to place it somewhere in your little tableau. And that's it. That's all you're trying to do. You're trying to build out large chunks of things. So there you go. Bunch of good stuff. These are all great for children. They're all great for adults. They're all great for anybody because they don't they're not trying to be children's games first, but they're trying to be accessible, which makes them good children's games.
All right, so that's everything for this week. Until next time, this is Chris.
Hey, and this is Anthony.
And we'll save you all a seat at the table. Take care.
Bye.